This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, November 4, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Critics say Bush's bird flu preparedness plan will benefit the pharmaceutical industry. Speculation continues around Eastern European secret CIA prisons. We'll hear from Warsaw. And the Summit of the Americas kicks off in Argentina, along with mass protests denouncing free trade. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Urban violence in France spread beyond the Paris region last night, with cars being set ablaze in several parts of the country. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
On the eighth night of violence, incidents were reported in Normandy and Seine-Maritime on the coast of the English Channel, and to the south in Burgundy and the Marseille region on the shores of the Mediterranean. But most of the reports are of cars being burnt, 600 in all throughout the country, and this is apparently France's most popular act of vandalism, so it's not clear if all cases are a result of the present unrest. In the Paris region, five warehouses were set ablaze and a bus depot caught fire, although the usually bullish Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy says that could have been an accident rather than arson. Officials say there were less confrontations with the police last night. They hope that the saturation of the Paris region with 1,300 officers, along with prison sentences for several alleged rioters, has dampened destructive urges. Public prosecutor François Molin has opened a case against persons unknown for failing to prevent the deaths of the two teenagers, which sparked the rioting. He says that so far there is no evidence that the police were chasing them. Local residents believe that they were fleeing an identity check, and resentment of the police is one of the main reasons for the eruption of violence. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Testimony was heard in two trials this week relating to allegations of police misconduct during Geneva's G8 protests in 2001. Manuela Aldave sends this report from Geneva.
More than 4 years after the protests, witnesses gave testimony this week in two police brutality cases stemming from the July 2001 anti-G8 demonstrations in Genoa. Opening testimony was heard in the case of the Diaz School incident. The prosecution includes 97 people who were hospitalized and later arrested after Italian police stormed the school building, which, at the time, was housing the Genoa Independent Media Center. The other case heard this week is the ongoing Bolzaneto prison trial. In this case, the prosecution alleges that 47 police and medical staff at the Bolzaneto prison abused detainees who were arrested during the G8 protests. Former detainees say they were beaten and pepper sprayed inside of the facility. Some say they were forced to shout out pro-fascist chants and sing racist songs. Charges brought against the defendants range from inflicting bodily harm to violations of international human rights conventions. Both trials are expected to last until next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mia Parsons, reading for Manuela Aldave in Genoa.
The president of Nigeria has arrived in Ivory Coast to try to broker a political deal that will be acceptable to all sides of the Ivorian conflict. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Nigerian President and African Union Chairman Olusegun Obasanjo will broker a deal that will see the appointment of a prime minister acceptable to the Ivorian government and the country's rebels. The prime minister will be charged with leading Ivory Coast towards a free and fair election. A political crisis that has lingered for the last 3 years has left Ivory Coast divided between a rebel-held north and a government-held south. Finding a prime minister that will be acceptable to both the Ivorian government and the rebels may prove a difficult task. Rebel leader Guillaume Osuru wants to be the new prime minister, but the government is not likely to accept him. The post of the new prime minister is very important to both sides of the conflict because the new prime minister will have powers over such strategic areas like defense, security, and electoral matters. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The House of Representatives has approved the Private Property Rights Act in a bid to block a recent ruling by the Supreme Court. Joseph McDonald has the story in Washington, D.C.
In Kelly versus New London, the Supreme Court ruled that state and local governments could seize private property needed for commercial development that would generate tax revenue. But congressional members, led by Henry Bonilla of Texas, have moved to block this ruling in a piece of legislation that would withhold money from state and local governments that expropriate private property for development purposes. Virginia Congressman Eric Cantor supports the bill. Cantor told the media yesterday that the right to private property must be preserved at all cost.
A man's home is his castle, and government should not be taking a man's castle away and giving it to another one just to build a bigger one.
The House approved the measure yesterday afternoon by an overwhelming 379-38 vote, and it will now move on to the Senate, where Texas Senator John Cornyn has introduced a corresponding piece of legislation. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Joseph McDonald.
Kenneth Tomlinson has resigned from the board of directors of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Tomlinson quit yesterday just before the conclusion of an inspector general's investigation into allegations of on-the-job improprieties. The CPB is a major source of funding for public radio and television. Tomlinson's critics say he tried to politically influence the content of public programming during his tenure. The inspector general's report is due out by mid-month. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush was greeted with mass protest as he made his way to the Fourth Summit of the Americas being held in Mar del Plata, Argentina. Bush admitted he is not likely to get a warm welcome in the Latin American country.
I want to thank you for being a good host. It's not easy to host all these countries, particularly not easy to host perhaps me. But thank you for doing it. You're doing a fine job.
34 heads of American countries, with the exception of Fidel Castro, are attending the conference, which will concentrate on the topic of external debt and free trade. FSRN's Kasim Termizi reports from Mar del Plata.
Creation of a hemisphere-wide free trade zone, known as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, will be a featured topic at the talks this weekend. Mercosur countries, which include Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay, are thus far opposed to the pact, but neighboring Chile, along with Mexico, the U.S., and Canada, are trying to push the trade zone through. President Bush attempted to highlight Latin American economic growth.
We wouldn't be having this discussion if our respective economies weren't strong. And the United States economy is strong. It's healthy. We've overcome some serious challenges.
Alan Siblis works with the Interdisciplinary Center for the Study of Public Policy in Buenos Aires. He disagrees and cites that Argentina's growth has hurt the common person.
Poverty and unemployment, while they have been dropping at a lot slower rates than people expected. Unemployment is still at 16%. And 40% of the population are below the poverty line, and 15% of the population is indigent, which means that they're hungry.
The Summit of the Americas will also consider the Bolivarian Alternatives for the Americas, a trade agreement presented by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, an alternative to the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Chavez also attended the People's Summit, which is being simultaneously held in Mar del Plata, and talked about the fact that poverty continues to grow in the region.
And today in Mar del Plata, it's the burial. We are going to bury the FTAA today here in Mar del Plata. Poverty has been growing in Latin America, thanks mainly to the capitalist model.
Demonstrations are scheduled to continue through the weekend. Protesters will attempt to enter the restricted zone where the conference is taking place. Reading for Kasim Termizi, I'm Max Pringle for Free Speech Radio News.
On Capitol Hill today, the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt outlined President Bush's $7.1 billion bird flu preparedness plan. Critics contend the plan relies heavily on antiviral drugs and vaccines that will become a gold mine for pharmaceutical companies, particularly for the sole maker of the drug Tamiflu, Roche. Mitch Jezerich reports.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Michael Leavitt laid out President Bush's $7.1 billion plan to combat a potential outbreak of the variant flu to Congress. He told the House Government Reform Committee that Bush's plan is much broader than just combating the bird flu.
Whether H5N1 will be the spark that creates a pandemic. But we do know that pandemics happen. They've happened in the past, they'll happen in the future. And this plan is not about H5N1 alone. It is about general pandemic preparedness.
Bush's plan would put resources towards international surveillance of potential outbreaks by building laboratories worldwide, having investigation teams ready to travel at a moment's notice, and signing joint agreements with other countries to contain an outbreak wherever it may arise. The plan also puts resources to domestic surveillance and to develop biosense technologies. But the largest bulk of the $7.1 billion plan would go to the development of vaccines and antiviral drugs. Democratic Representative Chris Van Hollings of Maryland criticized the plan, saying his priorities were off.
It's important to have antiviral drugs, but those stockpilings all assume and plan for the worst case. It seems to me we should be devoting more resources to preventing the worst case in terms of prevention at its source.
Levitt told the committee that his department will buy all 100 million purchases of the bird flu antiviral drug Tamiflu from the only company that makes it, the Swiss company Roche. Roche is the sole possessor of the intellectual property rights for Tamiflu until year 2016. But Levitt said he thinks beyond the patent rights, he doesn't believe any other companies are capable of making it anytime soon.
This is a highly complex process that involves as many as 5 different manufacturing processes, some of which involve quite dangerous explosive processes. Now, I don't believe it will be intellectual property disputes that in any way limit the capacity for manufacturing. It's going to be the logistics. And it's my view that it's going to be anywhere in the world more than a year before we have additional manufacturers.
Roche has indicated that 100 companies have approached it seeking licensing agreements. In the last economic quarter, Roche's revenue increased by 17% and sales of Tamiflu doubled. Roche is expected to make $1 billion next year off the sale of the antiviral drug. Dennis Kucinich is a Democratic representative of Ohio.
Of course they would want to hang on to this monopoly. Their ultimate responsibility is to their shareholders, not to the public. We've heard a lot of promises from Roche that they're willing to negotiate with other companies to sub-license production, but I've not heard anything about a firm agreement to do so. Roche can keep fees too high in order to make it unprofitable.
Kucinich then asked Levitt if he would issue compulsory licenses to allow other companies to make the Tamiflu drug.
You don't intend to issue compulsory licenses?
That's correct.
Why not?
Because it's my belief that if we want to have the last antiviral or new product we'll ever have in this country, we will begin to violate intellectual property and patent rights.
So you believe that intellectual property and patent rights are more important than having a large supply of an antiviral that could save lives?
I do not believe that violating their patent would unleash a new stream of Tamiflu.
Today, Roche pulled Tamiflu off the shelves of drugstores in Hong Kong. It has made similar moves with the United States and Canada after hordes of consumers were stockpiling the antiviral medication. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Poland and Romania have been pointed out as possible locations for secret CIA prisons. According to Human Rights Watch, flight records and other evidence indicate that both countries allowed their territories to be used by the CIA to hold top suspected Al-Qaeda captives in secret prisons. Both Polish and Romanian authorities immediately announced that no such prisons exist in their countries. Danuta Zhafraniec reports from Warsaw.
According to the Washington Post, such prisons exist in 8 countries, Poland being one of the suspected destinations for their detention. The whole story evolves around the mysterious Boeing 737 with an N3P tag, which allegedly made several flights to destinations in Macedonia, Afghanistan, Bulgaria, Romania, the Czech Republic and Poland. The Phantom plane was set to touch down at Szymany Airport, some 140 kilometers north of Warsaw, on September 22, 2003, on a covert mission directly from Kabul. According to John Sifton, an expert on terrorism of the American-based Human Rights Watch organization, the CIA chartered Boeing carried out missions to Poland in that year. Poland's Deputy Defense Minister Janusz Zemke rejected such claims for one main reason.
The airport in Szymany has not been used by the Polish military forces for many years. The Polish army does not even have its unit there anymore. So honestly, I cannot imagine whether the landing of a big aircraft would be possible there for technical reasons. I found such a theory extremely unlikely.
However, Human Rights Watch is skeptical about such explanations coming from Poland. Its representative Catherine Newell told Polish radio that she is not surprised that Polish authorities denied information as illegal.
For people at such a high level to say they were not aware should not be acceptable. It's extremely important that there be sufficient inquiry so that the Polish people can trust what the officials are saying and know that this is not happening on Polish soil. Poland did not go through its incredible history and search for democracy to end up having this kind of thing happening on Polish soil.
Poland's role, if confirmed, would be especially controversial since it is a newcomer to the European Union and has often been accused by some members for displaying sympathy towards the Americans. Robert Strybel, a Warsaw-based Western media correspondent, is not surprised by this line of thinking.
To a large extent, we live in a tabloid era. So much is either blown out of proportion or exaggerated, or a small bit of rumor is inflated to the point of becoming a major campaign or national disaster, that I would take this with a grain of salt until further evidence is produced. It's obvious that old Europe is very paranoid about the United States, and any signal that Poland is somehow, well, they call it conspiring. Poles would probably call it cooperating with their best ally. Poland is certainly America's best ally. It does ruffle feathers in Berlin and Paris, especially.
The European Commission has announced it would look into press reports that the CIA was running secret prisons in Eastern Europe. According to Friso Roskam-Ebing, an EC spokesman for Justice and Security Affairs, the Commission will further define its stance after the examination. Obviously, the existence of secret prisons does not seem to me to be compatible with the EU's Fundamental Rights Charter, he added. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
It's been 10 years since Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin stood at a rally attended by thousands of supporters and was gunned down by a fellow Jew who opposed negotiations with the Palestinians. Israel is now commemorating the anniversary with a series of memorials and assessing the legacy of the fallen Prime Minister. Iris Mackler reports from Jerusalem.
Songs dedicated to the slain Prime Minister are being played on Israeli radio, tributes and programs being aired on television as the nation gazes inwards. The anniversary of the first Israeli Prime Minister to be assassinated has become a time for national assessment. Israel's Chief Justice Aharon Barak says that the bullet that felled Yitzhak Rabin also punctured Israel's democracy. The bullet didn't just hit him, it also hit us. Our rule of law and our equality before the law, says the Chief Justice. Israel has a strong democracy, but Rabin's death has shown us that if we don't defend our democracy, it won't defend us. Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says Rabin's legacy is that he forced Israeli society to an internal reckoning and a comprehension that it would have to trade land for peace in order to remain a Jewish state and a democratic one. A centre has been established in Yitzhak Rabin's name. It's carrying out civics lectures at schools and universities and in the Israeli army, aimed at promoting ideals of peace and tolerance. Meanwhile, as Israeli TV and radio play and replay the shooting of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin 10 years ago, Rabin's killer Yigal Amir is seeking an early release from jail. Rabin's killer confessed his guilt at the time and returned to the scene to show a police video camera how he'd done it. Now Amir is seeking clemency. He wants easing of his prison conditions and early release. The latest polls show that 20% of Israelis think Amir should be released early. However, a pardon is granted by the country's president. At a national memorial service for Rabin at Israel's presidential palace, President Moshe Katsav said he would never grant clemency to Yigal Amir. This murderer is not eligible for pardon, or for easing of his conditions, or for clemency, says Israel's president. This is the national consensus, and I'll recommend to the next president that he shouldn't grant him clemency either. Israel's holding memorial services around the country today, culminating tomorrow in a rally in the square where Rabin was shot. It's to be attended by his negotiating partner, former US President Bill Clinton. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
This week marks the Memorial Day for the Japanese Peace Constitution's first announcement. There are several right-wing Japanese politicians and business leaders who are trying to amend this peace constitution so that Japan can attain real military power. Sending Japanese self-defense forces to Iraq could be understood in the context of this movement. Now, peace-loving people throughout Japan and Asia in general are worried that this movement could amend the Japanese peace constitution and threaten peace throughout the Asian region. And, as FSRN's Yoonji Kang reports, many Korean and Japanese NGOs and academics got together to make a joint action against this movement in Seoul and Korea.
On November 3, 1946, Japan announced the creation of a pacifist constitution immediately after its defeat in World War II. A couple of weeks ago, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, adopted a first draft of its new constitution. The move raises concerns amongst Japan's neighbors. Many, like Kimijima Akiko, a law professor of Ritsumeikan University, believe that this is an opportunity for the U.S. and Japan to forge greater ties.
There are very conservative politicians, and behind them, there's the United States. The U.S. wants Japanese self-defense forces to cooperate with the U.S. troops' activities. Secondly, I believe that in Japanese business groups, there is a movement to amend Act 9 of the Constitution. There are many Japanese companies in other countries, transnational companies. They need a strong military power to protect these businesses' interests abroad.
The draft comes at a time when the U.S. is negotiating the realignment of troops in Japan and sees its ally as a strategic partner in global security. Many Koreans, like Lee Kyung-ju, a Korean law professor of Inha University, says that all Asians are concerned about Japanese military expansion.
Though the amendment of the Japanese Constitution is not a Korean matter, we should pay serious attention to this movement because the main point of this movement is a matter of military policy and Japanese foreign policy. That's why Koreans and Chinese should watch out for this. Also, the establishment of Japan's peace constitution was a Japanese promise to the Asian region that it would not break into war again.
Changes to the constitution would allow Japan preemptive abilities as Japan sees a growing threat from North Korea and China. But with North Korea underway, many believe this could be a big obstacle to the process. Kim Sung-guk, a Korean peace activist, points out the relations between the six-way talks and the Japanese constitution amendment issue.
They are not directly or intentionally related. But if the six-way talks didn't go well, so the North Korean threat intensified, it would give Japanese conservatives a good reason to move toward the amendment. But if the six-way talks could yield a good solution, it could weaken the justification of the amendment, because the Japanese are using the North Korean threat to amend the peace constitution and go toward a strong military and intensify Japan as a U.S. ally.
On Monday, the U.S. and Japan finalized the plans to consolidate their military powers, which would allow for joint military operations in the region. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang in Seoul, Korea.
As a new film about the international movement challenging Walmart's business practices debuts in New York and LA tonight, Walmart sponsored a conference in Washington, D.C. today about its positive impact on the U.S. economy. Before the private research group paid by Walmart presented its study this morning, a union launched a new association for Walmart employees to improve their working conditions. Ingrid Drake has more from D.C.
Over the next 2 weeks, several hundred screenings of Robert Greenwald's new documentary, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, will take place across the United States and in dozens of other countries. Greenwald, who also directed Outfoxed about the Fox Broadcasting Network, has documented the international campaign against the world's largest retail chain. which has approximately 5,000 stores.
Give me an M.
Sam Walton, I don't think would be comfortable with the way things are going right now. I don't think this is why he started the store. It wasn't to crush other competition.
They're the biggest, they're the most powerful, they have the most money. They don't need to talk to anybody. They don't need to negotiate with anybody.
Walmart is the target of several class action lawsuits and grassroots campaigns to prevent the store from opening in communities. Today, Walmart sponsored a conference a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol in the White House about Walmart's national and regional economic impact. Chris Holling from Global Insight, the international research company hired by Walmart, reported that Walmart has created 210,000 jobs with wages that match the skills, experience, and education of its workers.
It's not a zero-sum game that Walmart does not seem to completely displace other retail at an aggregate level. And again, in your typical county for which the simulation was done, the 137 jobs represents a 3.7% increase in retail employment in the typical county that was used in this analysis.
Walmart spokesperson Ray Bracey would not disclose the cost of its contract with Global Insight and said the research findings are not biased.
This company has a lot of integrity. They have an important name, and they're filled with a lot of prominent economists. You cannot buy their results. They've got too much at stake. They do too much work for others. And that was a going-in position for all of the firms that we provided requests for proposals, and certainly it was true with Global Insights.
Walmart's economic conference also boasted that its store's low prices save working families more than $2,000 a year. This marketing ploy will not improve Walmart's public image, claims Chris Kofinas with the Wake Up Walmart campaign, a project of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union.
You cannot exploit workers or any person that works hard to justify passing on savings to another. This argument does not fly with the American people. American people do not wake up and say the only thing we value is the dollar. The only thing that we value is savings. That is completely misreading the American people. The American people value values. They believe companies, especially one of the most profitable companies in the world, have to reflect the best of American values.
Before Walmart's conference began this morning, in the same hotel, the Wake Up Walmart campaign announced the launch of Walmart Workers of America Association. Kofinas says the association will be outreaching to more than 100,000 Walmart employees over the next month to provide them with information, resources, and training in how to improve their working conditions.
They are actively critical to making this company one of the most profitable companies in America and the world with $10.5 billion in profits. They work hard every day to make this company a $290 billion giant. And at a minimum, they deserve to have a living wage. They deserve to have affordable health care. They deserve not to be mistreated or discriminated against. They deserve, for instance, to work in a safe working conditions. Those aren't wrong things. Those are the right things.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective produced out of Pacifica stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. For copies of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can log on to our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.